My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from 3 Weeks Edinburgh. I am at the Edinburgh Festival 2025. I'm sitting in the club bar at Assembly George Square, right at the heart of the fringe, and I'm going to be talking to performers who are appearing at this year's festival, talking past, present, and future, their journey in comedy to date, this year's show, and what is happening next. Today, Katie Boyle, who is performing her show, Roe vs. Wade vs. Katie, at Monkey Barrel Comedy at the Tron this festival. Let's get TW talking with Katie. So we are back in the club bar at Assembly. I have my next guest here ready to talk about their show, but also past, present and future, how we got here as well. So Katie Boyle has joined us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I think we're about halfway through the festival now. So how are we feeling?
Good. Tired.
I think that's normal,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's going well.
Yeah, great. Loving it so far.
We are going to talk more about your show in a while. But before that, well, let's start at the start of your comedy journey. So at what point did you decide that comedy was something that you wanted to perform?
I was living in New York for a few months. This was over 10 years ago. I started comedy 10 years ago this month, but I was working as an art intern, and I just hated it.
An art intern?
Yeah.
Don't even know what that means.
So I was in a big museum, and they have interns come, but it was like 50 hours a week, unpaid. It was not what I had learned in college, and I was just, kind of miserable. And then my first friends were all from Latin America, and I would tell them stories, and they were like, oh, you should do comedy. And that was kind of really it. We went to a show and they let audience members tell a joke. So I just decided to get up and do that. And then I loved it.
Blimey. So your stories were so good just in the workplace that the people were saying this should go on stage.
I think Irish people are just naturally good storytellers as well. So maybe I just, didn't notice it before because everybody was just telling good stories. But then when you're taken out of that context and that was it. Like, I'd never watched stand-up really before. I didn't know a lot of comedians. But once I got on stage, I was like, oh, I love this. I want to keep doing it.
And so you're still in New York at this point?
Yeah.
And so were you doing like open mic nights and that
sort
of thing?
Yeah, like the next day, like 3 open mics a night, minimum. It was crazy.
I guess there are very few places in the world where you can be doing 3 of them a night. I guess that's what, being somewhere like New York, there's lots of places to get up on stage and grab that mic.
Yeah. And like that venue that I had, that they had audience members could tell a joke, they had a bunch of open mics in it. So the next night when I went down, people were like, oh, you can do this open mic, and you could do like 6, 8, 10, midnight. So that was all in one venue at the time, which is closed down now. But yeah, so when I started, I could just really get into it.
So you started doing these open mic nights literally kind of out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So was it immediately obvious what kind of jokes you were going to tell, what you're going to say on stage? Or did that evolve over a period of time?
Yeah, it definitely evolved. I just tried to tell funny stories. And then I bought a book that was apparently a book that told you what a joke was. And then you were meant to read the book and then unlearn the book. But still was helpful because I didn't even
know. You need to know the rules in order to break them.
Yeah. They were like, this is what an analogy is. But I had really bad stage fright, and I'd never performed before. So that took me a really long time. So I'm glad I started in New York and had all that stage time to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, so I guess in that early stage, partly it was what you're going to say on stage, but more of it was just having the nerves to get up there in front of an audience and see how it goes.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of people who get opportunities quick, or like are really good quick, they usually have an acting background or they were in theatre. And I didn't have either of those. So I needed like loads of years just to figure out how to like move on stage. You can kind of have that in New York. There's so many, underground shows and mics and stuff.
So you talked about these stories that your friend said you should tell these stories on stage. I mean, so then once you were on stage and you're starting to do more open mic nights and more regular stuff, I mean, is it stories predominantly from your life? Is those the sort of stories that you're telling? Or are you sort of making stuff up and being fictionalized? Or is it a mixture of the two?
No, it's all stories from my life. Just some are exaggerated or some are like... what if this had happened? But no, it's all basically mainly honest stories.
and how does it feel sort of getting up on stage and in essence exposing your life in that way and maybe the people around you? Is that a nervous thing to do? Or actually just, as you say, maybe it's the Irish storyteller thing, is something naturally that you would do anyway?
I think like Irish storytelling is more like with your friends and in a group, but there is something sort of terrifying to be up on stage and putting yourself out there. And especially I came from a small town where if anyone did kind of anything different, it was a bit like, oh, like, who do you think you are? What do they think they're doing? So it was very freeing to be able to do that and sort of learn not to care what people think. Or if, like, it's the ultimate, you know, when they say you should read that book about like not caring, I think it's like don't give an F or something. I should just do stand up. Because, do you know what I mean? Like if you survive people not liking your set, like you're like, okay, the world doesn't end and it's not a big deal in the end. So I thought that was very, it helped with anxiety as well.
So you were doing these open mic nights in New York. I mean, was there a point at which you were sort of like, okay, this is something I'm dabbling with. No, actually, this is my career. This is what I'm going to do.
No, straight away I knew.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, immediately. Yeah, because I'd always wanted to be an artist, but when I went to work at this museum, and it was like a big museum in New York, that's not what I'd learned in art college in Ireland. In Ireland, it's more accessible, I felt, and it was more, I don't know, just like regular people working together. But when I worked as an intern in this place, every other intern was from like really, really rich families. I'd never met people who had that much money. And they were using like words, like four syllable words multiple times in a sentence. So, whereas with comedy, it was just like, oh, this is like a form of art that's for everybody. And like in New York, it's not just who you know or you have to understand this. Like everybody from all walks of life. And you didn't need to, I didn't have a studio. I didn't have all the stuff I had in Ireland because of college. So it was like the cheapest way to be creative.
So you were doing these open mic nights. How did you then progress into sort of like, I guess, did you then look for the club spots? Is that what you're doing sort of, you know, to actually, rather than just doing the open mic thing, to actually begin that journey as a comedian?
Yeah, I think like 2 months in, I started my own show because I'd gotten a lot of advice from older comics when I started because I didn't want to just have, you know, put in all this effort to get to New York to be an artist and then completely switch up. And having gotten an internship in an amazing museum, I didn't want to be like just like throw it all away. So a lot of comics were like, oh, you should run your show because then you'll get in front of audiences and that'll make you better quicker. So I did that. Then I,
and when you say run your own show, so that was putting on your own night and getting other comedians along and then you succeed?
Yeah, so you're getting like real audiences, not just, so open mics in New York are like, it could be like 100 comics just in looking at their notebooks because they're just trying to get up to get to do their 2 minutes. Whereas if you're on your own show, you get a chance to do maybe like 8 to 10 minutes emceeing and then meeting all these other comics in front of audiences. And because I'd worked at the museum, I kind of knew how to like put on events and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I got to say, you say put on a show as if that's the easiest thing in the world to do. But that, I guess, means finding a venue, yeah, figuring it out, finding an audience for your show and then booking in the other comedians.
Yeah, I know. That was, it wasn't like too crazy at the time because, I just like knew how to put on an event because I'd done that in internship, which was just like, you know, hit up these online places that submit your events. Or I didn't have like, social media wasn't a big thing then. So it was more just the people would go to like Skint. So if you got into Skint, your show, people would go to your show. So you actually had less competition at the time to try to promote your show. And then most people just, if you got it in at a venue that had comedy shows as well, you'd have like a bit of an audience. But
now, I guess you were still in the era because it's like mid-2010s we're talking about, or pre-pandemic, I guess.
Yeah. So this is 10 years ago.
And it's still the era where, yeah, comedy very much was, it all began on stage. Mm-hmm. It was live, find your audience. I guess you were in the perfect city to be doing that. You had the skills, put on your own show. And it was really only as recent, even though obviously social media, YouTube, etc. have been around for 20 years, but it was only really in the pandemic that started to become a place where people could try and find an audience rather than find an audience and then stay in touch with Facebook or Twitter or whatever.
Yeah, which is brilliant. You know, it changed my career. So I love social media for that. But it's also nice to have been come up in the time when they didn't have it. Like, I'm glad the first 5 years of comedy, we didn't have social media. I'm glad those clips aren't out there.
That's the other thing, isn't it? Yes, yeah, so your entire career gets documented.
There's still really bad clips from 5 years ago, though. So, it's nice that we had that kind of, where it was just, I got to come up in both of those eras.
So you were doing your own night. You were sort of starting to do other sets. I mean, I guess as the years went by and you were doing longer sets, presumably, was that sort of format that you got pretty quickly at the start? Is it the same format or has it evolved and changed over that decade?
I guess when we started, it was all about like, get your type five, all these comps. Like, you need to do late night TV. Everybody needs to have a type five, which was different from hearing the comedians back home, where it's all about get an hour quickly so you can go to Fringe.
That's interesting. Yeah, so you've got the size of the US approach versus the UK Ireland approach.
Yeah, whereas UK and Ireland, they're putting out hours every year.
Yeah.
And in the States, it was 10 years for 1 hour. Which I haven't done. I've done 3 hours in 10 years. So I definitely was inspired by the way UK and Irish acts just turn out, and Australian as well, just turn out material and aren't as precious with it maybe. Like, you know, I guess you just have to let it go and, you know, that's done and move on. But I did, the 5 minute thing was like, oh, so you could audition into getting into clubs. And I had done that 2 years in, and then I got to start as a really baby comic in a club where you just get check spots. I think I only got 3 that year. The following year I had to re-audition because there was a new booker. So then they did this late night thing where they'd let young comics do like 5 minutes after a show, and if audiences wanted to stay. And then I just was there for years, got up to doing guest spots, which is unpaid 8 minute spots, then hosting, which is paid, and then hosting on weekends, and then regular paid spots, and then 20 minute spots on the weekend. And now that comedy club are my managers. So I was 8 years in with them growing. And then when they became a management company, they signed me. So.
And then you've got the representation
to
progress. But I think it's really interesting saying, yeah, I think that in the UK, Ireland, that is the impact of Edinburgh, isn't it? This idea that every 12 months, whatever you're doing in the clubs and whatever you're doing during the year, you have that August deadline to do an hour of, now whether that's you've got an hour of material ready by August or you create an entire standalone new hour show for Edinburgh, whereas in the US it is much more you slowly growing. And I guess in the US, I mean, is the output in the US though, the objective in the US for most comedians, would you say ultimately to get into the TV side of it, is that what most people are aspiring to?
Maybe. I think a lot of them is, yeah, they'd love to get on TV. And I think a lot also think, oh, I'd love to be on TV, or if I get on TV, that'll get me more fans.
Yeah.
But I do think that is better over here, the kind of constantly create, constantly putting out a different hour, because there's still a lot of comics who tour in America who are going back to the same cities with the same hour, or the same hour that's been on Netflix, or the same. So it's, I think audiences don't mind hearing the same joke sometimes, but like the whole same hour. So they're creating 1 hour, but then they blow up and then
they tour it for years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like that's also not their fault, because they're not getting the chance like Fringe to come and have a... But I think a lot more American comedians are coming over here now and they're changing that up, which is great. Like I saw, there were so many great American comedians here working on hours now. So that's exciting that it's become this global. Everybody's learning from each other.
So you've mentioned you've done 3 1-hour shows over the last decade. So when was the first one? When did you decide, I'm going to do the Edinburgh-style one-hour show?
Well, it was actually more an American style because they tape specials and put them out on YouTube.
Yes.
So I did that. And I know that comics do that here as well, but it wasn't like inspired by Edinburgh. I just wanted to headline in the States. And you can't headline if you can't prove that you can do an hour. So I taped a special. And a way to do that if you're not headlining is you just break it up into 15 minutes and work on those 15 minutes in the clubs. And then maybe ask like crappier rooms. Not that they're crappy, but they're like, you're not going to get any money. And they're like, you know, in a bar in the middle of Pennsylvania or something.
But they'll let you film.
Yeah, no, not even film. You just ask, can you run it?
Ah, right. To do a full hour. I get it. Yeah. To take those 15 minutes, glue them together.
And practice it. And then I filmed it at the comedy club that I was working at, New York Comedy Club. And then, yeah, we put it on YouTube. And then it did really well. Like, I think it's at like 600,000 views now, but it's been up for like 2 years. It took a year to sort of get it ready, and then it came out, and then that helped me get into better clubs on the road because it was proof of concept. And then I was able to tour in the States, and then I was working on a new hour, so I taped that in November, put that out, and that just came out in July. So that is called Therapy. So that's a different hour. But then my manager booked the Fringe very last minute. There was an opportunity for me to come over. And I said, well, I'm putting out that other special. I don't want to keep doing this hour that's already going
to
be out.
That's interesting, isn't it? So yeah, so you have the opportunity quite last minute to come to Edinburgh. You've got 2 1-hour shows in the bag, which we've not seen here. But you were like, no, I've got something new to put the Fringe.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have fun doing either of them anymore. And I have ADHD, so kind of novelty is gone. But I also was like, this is the perfect opportunity to talk about material that I probably don't get a chance to in New York because of shorter sets, or maybe on the road. I'd be nervous in certain parts of America as well, talking about the topics that I was talking about at Fringe. So I had just gone through something 2 months previously. And so when my manager was like, Fringe is a good opportunity. And then I was like, okay, well, I want to write this new hour. And I had loads of stories that didn't fit into my other 2 hours that felt they would fit with this. And then he was like, that's grand. You can use my club. So I did like 3 or 4 shows at his, trying to work it out. And then I did an Irish work in progress tour before coming here in July.
So you alluded to this year's show, the Fringe show, the first Edinburgh show there. So just give us the overview of what are those topics that you're covering specifically in this hour?
So it's like at the start, abortion rights, and then like kind of more fun stories, but it all leads to an abortion. So I had to have one in America in February. And the reason why, when my manager was like, oh, you should go to the Fringe, I was like, okay, this is the perfect place to try to talk about this, because it's like, you know, I feel like Fringe is like, you can do your whatever. But you can't really do that like 10 minutes or 15 minutes on a New York club set, because I also don't want to trigger anybody or traumatize anybody. So at least with like this hour. And but yeah, I decided to do it because I didn't regret it. And I'm glad it was an option. And I grew up in Ireland where we didn't have it as an option. I moved to the more progressive country, I thought. And they're taking that away in America. And like, I see myself as like maybe a third American at this point. I've lived in that country for a third of my life. And then to think that Ireland has it now, but it's still, there's a lot of shame in Ireland. It's still very controversial. The information for women is like, you know, education, like sex or the pill, all the things. The only reason why I had to get an abortion is because I didn't actually have the education that they try to hide. Where actually, if you just give us the education and you talk about abortion, most people wouldn't end up having to get an abortion. So that's what kind of the show leads to, like that you're watching me and you're like, oh, like she's having this journey. She's not like, I'm not a bad person. And I don't regret. I'm glad it was an option, but it is last resort. And so the show also talks about that too. I just explain what the process was with jokes. So yeah, I really like, I'm happy with the show. So, and I'm happy with people's responses so far.
And as you say, what's great about this festival, I mean, also, I guess, just being in this country versus certainly what's happening in the US at the moment. And as you say, also Ireland's got an interesting history on that topic. Yeah. So A, you're in a country where it's not quite as contentious. Well, obviously, as you said, for some people, it is very triggering, but it's not the big, massive political issue that it is certainly in the US at the moment. But also, this is a festival where you can sort of take topics on that you may not feel 10 minutes in a New York club is the right place. Yeah. Because that's what audiences are expecting. They're expecting a narrative. They're expecting potentially some serious bits, even in a show that is there ultimately to make you laugh.
Yeah, exactly. And I also just don't want to like get murdered. Like I talked about it on an Irish radio or TV show, and like then Conor McGregor. Now, this is sarcasm in case people don't get it, but I was going to say the man that represents our country so well, but then some people might not get that I'm being sarcastic. He's horrible. But he screenshot me out of context and put it up, and then I got all this hate, but I got loads of death threats. And that wasn't just from people in Ireland, and it was from some people in Ireland because their pages were all open. You could see they were like their workplace, their address was on it. So they weren't like just robots. But at the same time, there was also a lot of people in America who follow him, and they were like, yeah, when you're in New York, we're going to, and they were saying like crazy stuff, like we're going to crucify you, shoot you, which is like, that logic doesn't make sense. Because if you think that I like, okay, which was an embryo, that it is then a fetus, but you think I killed a person, so your logic is then it's okay to kill me, is like madness. But that's what I mean. This is just, but it just shows how like, the topic should be talked about and it should be normalized. The women shouldn't have to deal with that stuff. And yeah, like I can take the hate because I've been getting it for you know, at least 5 years posting online.
Do you think the sense in the US is, because it's such a big country and so much stuff happens at a state level, obviously Roe versus Wade was a massive US-wide federal decision, but it does feel like it, state to state, is very different in the US. But even in somewhere like New York, do you sense that sort of where before we'd made all this progress and then watching it sort of seem to pedal back? Or are you feeling that even in New York?
Yeah,
not just in sort of, you know, certain more conservative parts of the US.
When I went into the gynecologist and found out I was pregnant at 6 weeks, she said, which is very quick, and it is crazy that it was that quick, because all of my friends who are older than me were like, oh, because I'd taken the morning after pill. And I had taken that within a few hours. The pharmacist who interviewed me in Ireland was even like, oh, you're taking this so quick. Like, there was no point that I thought that I would, that wouldn't work. And then my friends were like, oh, no, just wait till your second missed period. Like, oh, you don't need to worry. But another friend who's like so OCD, she won't even let her partner enjoy himself in the same room, you know, sort of like he's like out in the garage. So she was like so afraid of like sex and getting pregnant. So I did do it. But it was crazy because when I went to my gynecologist, she was like, you're so lucky you're in New York. And I have friends who are in Florida, and like, if anything happened or they even like tried to get pregnant and something happened and they needed those, they could die. So like, that's crazy that my gynecologist's first thing was, you're just so lucky you're in New York. Like, that's a wild thing that we're even considering.
So given that what shouldn't be a contentious topic is such a contentious topic, particularly in the US, what is the plan for the show? Are you thinking of putting this on YouTube with the other two, or do you think that's not appropriate for this show? Will you be touring it back in the US?
Yeah, I don't know because, you know, at least at the Fringe, it's there, the name is there. I don't think people are going to come and like attack you. There is more of a chance in America. So I really don't know. I'll talk to my managers about it. But yeah, I guess eventually it probably would end up on YouTube or something. That's usually what I do. But I really don't know.
It's frustrating, isn't it? Because all of those legitimate concerns you've got to navigate, yet it feels like if there's a place where the message of your show is needed,
it's
in the States.
So I probably should just do it. I think The Fringe will also make it so that it's easier to deal with certain stuff. Like, there was a woman in the show the other night, and I always set up, like, do you know what the show is about? So that no one is getting... And there's like so many fun, silly stories in it. So it's not like, and it's not like shock humor meant to be provocative or anything. It's just meant to, if anything, it's meant to, that you see me as a human and you're like, oh, like I could be friends with her. Oh shit, she went through this thing. Oh, I shouldn't hate her.
Yeah.
And like, oh, it actually sounds like she made the right decision for it. That's kind of pretty much the whole thing. But there was a woman, and I think her partner had brought her, and I think he might've been a fan of me. And I don't think he had fully explained what the show was about. Now, I did up top, but instead of her just leaving, she was like huffing, turning into the wall. She looked visibly uncomfortable. And the first topics are kind of jokes about my dad and abortion rights. So they're not about me, but it's like fun. And then I talk about St. Bridget and abortion rights. And that's also like, so, but then when I got into my normal kind of like dating stuff, she was fine. And then when I switched back to leading back into abortion stuff, she very visibly was uncomfortable. And so I just paused the show. And I just said to her, like, hey, I can see you're visibly uncomfortable. You 100% don't have to stay here. And you can just ask the door, tell them I said that you can have a refund. I don't want anyone to feel like they have to sit through something that makes them uncomfortable, they don't agree with, or they're feeling triggered. And then she was like, oh, it just makes me feel bad for women who have lost babies. And I said, like, that's totally fair, but that is a separate situation. Like, if we force women to have a baby, those other women are not going to get a baby. Do you know what I mean? There's just going to be two people who are still miserable or unhappy. They're like separate things. And then she was like, no, that's fair. That's fair. And I was like, no, like, that's fine. But it's better than, instead of you talking about it here, being upset or like talking to your boyfriend because it's distracting. At any point, because it's going to get worse, just walk out. No one's going to look at you. That's fine. But I'm not going to come back into this. And you've had the option to leave. And then she was fine for the rest of it. And she even took a selfie at the end, and her boyfriend gave me
£20. So
she
just needed that sort of recognition.
Yeah.
Suddenly she was like, okay,
yeah,
I no longer feel I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah. And it's a separate issue.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if we get into that, you know, then women are nearly the same as cows.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think was going to happen if abortion wasn't available or I was forced to have a child? I wasn't going to run around going, who can't have one?
Yeah.
Take this, like, you know, I probably would have had the child and we'd be miserable.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, the show, I talk about not everybody loves their family members, and I come from a thing where I don't speak to my mother, so you know what I mean. I don't know. I think Yeah, and you know, we did the things that, and I still ended up in a situation because the education wasn't there. So, yeah, so I don't know, but, you know, we'll see. But no one's, you know, that was the only person who seemed upset, and no one's like thrown anything at me. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, there's a girl in America, a comic, who someone threw a beer at her for talking about Trump. I think that's what my fear is. It is more visceral. Like, all she did was make a joke about Trump, and she got a beer thrown at her. So, I think they'll feel more upset about abortion. Actually, I don't know. They really like Trump.
Some of them do, don't they?
They really like Trump.
That is true. Well, we should wrap things up there. But before we do that, let's just do the listings for the rest of the run. So tell us the time of day, the venue, etc.
So it's 10:05 every night at the Tron, which is Monkey Barrel underneath a pub called O'Neill's. The only days I'm not here are the 16th, 17th and 18th because I have to fly back to the States, of course. So I could call back in the middle of it, but here up until then. And then after that, you know. So,
through to the end of the festival.
Yeah, so hope you come.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. I hope you have a good rest of the run.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.